You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Well, I am Allison Brown. I am a new program officer with the Equality Fund here at Open Society Foundations. And this was the Freedom Summer documentary, and we will be screening this documentary at several historically black colleges and universities around the country over the next year, and having conversation about black civic participation and what that means for equity and for the movements happening for equity right now. And this conversation, I think, is a perfect launch. I want to, before we get into this wonderful panel, I want to welcome my colleague, Erica, to come talk to us about the work of the Democracy Fund and the work that you all have been doing in Shelby County.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Erica Teasley-Linick. I'm in the Democracy Fund. And we didn't really plan for me to spend a lot of time today to talk to you about the work that we've been doing. But after watching what was a really powerful documentary, and I don't know how many of you had a chance to see everything, but it was, you know, really moving. We were in the room feeling all kinds of feelings. I know I was. And thinking about how we're 50 years now ahead of time. We just saw 50 years ago. There are so many similarities today that it's frightening. And that was really one of the takeaways that I had. It was a sort of a powerful takeaway that there were a lot of things that we saw happening then that we know are still happening today with the work that we're doing and supporting the grantees that are doing work to fight some of the same things then which are happening now. There are folks that don't want people of color to vote. They don't want poor people to vote. And they're making sure that there are voter suppression legislation measures that are being passed throughout different states, not just in the South, but in other states as well. And so one of the things that we're doing is trying to support the work of those grantees that are working to fight against the voter suppression measures. There is the Shelby Response Fund, which was set up last year. As many of us know, there was a Supreme Court decision last year, last June, in Shelby County, Alabama, where part of the Voting Rights Act, which was actually referenced in the film, one of the speakers said, you know, the Voting Rights Act was set up and there has been supervision over, I think he had named seven states in the South that were being monitored by the Department of Justice and by the federal government, seven jurisdictions that had had a history of discrimination. And so Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was that part of the Voting Rights Act that protected folks from voter discrimination in places where there had been a past history of discrimination. So last year, the Supreme Court decision in Shelby invalidated that section. And so now it's basically up to, it's sort of like, you know, rough justice out there. Everyone's just trying to make sure that they can capture data, capture stories from people who are trying to register to vote, who are trying to exercise their right to vote, and try to find out, you know, how is it that now in the face of this, now what has been taken away, there is no longer this federal involvement in this area, that it's now the opportunity or in the, and the responsibility of others to sort of, you know, figure out what's going on. So the Shelby Response Fund was set up, and we have been supporting that work to in three different areas. So the first phase is litigation. The second has been in trying to provide state and local infrastructure capacity so that people can, in fact, meet with local legislators and local officials, election officials, to find out what's going on. Are there any changes in voting happening? Are they moving polling places? Are they, introducing new legislation to provide for voter ID and other measures like that? And then the third component is in communications and making sure that there's a pro-franchise narrative that we can, craft that can go out there to make sure that people understand that these measures are not preventing fraud, which, you know, there's no evidence there has been voter fraud, but instead that these are measures that are stopping people from exercising their right to vote. There are several states. We have some good news that has sort of in the last week, we've had a couple of court cases where there have been some really huge, we think, gains with respect to the voter ID laws that have been passed and in the stoppages on early voting in Ohio. So on Thursday, the federal judge said that they couldn't end the early voting that had previously been established. So folks will still be able to do that, and that the voter ID provisions have been invalidated as well. And so that was a big gain. In Alaska, which is also one of the states, so it's not a southern state, and it's a state we don't talk about, but there are Native voters, Native Alaskans, who have had their voting rights denied, and especially with respect to the language assistance provisions of the Voting Rights Act, where if there's a certain number of folks who speak a language, then you have to provide voting materials in those languages. And so for the Native Alaskans, there was a decision that they had been, in fact, the state had been discriminating against those voters by not providing language assistance in two of the native languages. So that happened on Thursday as well. There was another gain in Wisconsin, where the court invalidated the voting, the voter ID provisions. We're currently in, where grantees are currently in litigation in Texas, where, and this started this week, where they're looking at the voter ID laws there. And there, if you show your gun license, that qualifies as being valid voter ID, but student ID is not a valid ID. So there are some issues there. Lale was pointing out that we saw an article where it talked about a Mississippi voter, an older Mississippi voter who lives in Texas. She's having difficulty getting voter ID because it costs $42 and she would rather eat. You know, there are other priorities that people have. And so it just shows that still there are these qualifications that people have to have. There are hoops that are people have to jump through in order to have their right to vote. And so it's very current. You know, watching it, it was all in black and white, and it felt like it was a long time ago, and people were wearing different clothing, and they had different hairstyles, but you know, we are still experiencing a lot of these same things today. So I think that was my takeaway from the film.
Thank you so much, Erica. So we are in this moment now, 50 years later, as Erica says, but we've seen a movement that's coming out of Ferguson, Missouri after Michael Brown was killed, and a movement that young people have really taken control of and are leading. We are seeing people really working to change the mindsets that existed 50 years ago and try to change those mindsets from the core. And so I'm really thrilled to be having this conversation today, 50 years after Freedom Summer, and to be joined by these incredible panelists. So I will introduce each of you in turn, and then I'll ask of you five to seven minute intro, your reflections on the film and your thoughts, especially from your experiences and the work that you've done over the years. So to my left is Arya Nair, who is President Emeritus of Open Society Foundations. He was National Executive Director of the ACLU, and in 1964 was Field Director of the ACLU, and he is one of the founders of Human Rights Watch. Cortland Cox is in Washington, D.C. He's formerly of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and now of the SNCC Legacy Project. Jonathan Stith is also in Washington, D.C. He's a youth organizer and the National Coordinator for the Alliance for Educational Justice. And in Budapest, we have Anna Szilla Daroksi, former gender studies student at CEU, HIA Lantos Fellow at the U.S. Congress, and former gender research fellow at the European Roma Rights Center. And I just want to underscore that this is an international conversation. While we are experiencing this movement that is coming out of Ferguson and other areas around the country, New York City included, Romani people are fighting also for equity. We have indigenous people fighting in Latin America. So this is an international conversation, and OSF is the perfect organization to host that conversation. So Arya, if I may turn to you for your thoughts on Freedom Summer and on
okay.
the film and where we are.
Well, I immensely enjoyed watching the film because I think it was a true portrayal of what took place at that time. And also it brought back for me a sense of the intensity of the issues in that period. I was at that point a fairly new staff member of the American Civil Liberties Union. I had started work for the ACLU in June 1963, And my responsibility was to develop state affiliates for the ACLU where they did not then exist, and also assist the existing affiliates of the ACLU in upgrading their activities. We didn't have many state affiliates of the ACLU in the Deep South in that period. The only states where there were ACLU affiliates then in that region were Louisiana, centered around the city of New Orleans, and Florida, centered around Miami. And obviously there were enormous civil liberties problems elsewhere in the region. We had volunteer lawyers we could call upon in other places, but in Mississippi we didn't even have that. We basically had nothing in Mississippi during that period. And one of the first projects that I engaged in on behalf of the ACLU was establishing a Southern Regional Office, which we launched in 1964, based in Atlanta. And the main focus of the office was dealing with voting rights and election law issues. And I should say that the election law issues were as important as the voting rights issues, because where blacks were registered to vote, everything was done to minimize the impact of their voting. So if you take a state, let's say, which had a population of 60% whites and 40% blacks, let's say it had five members of Congress, if you could draw the districts so that most of the blacks were in one congressional district, you'd have four whites and one black who could get elected to Congress. But then if you wanted to eliminate the one black and have all five representatives be white, you'd have at-large voting in the state, which meant that for every seat in Congress, everybody cast a vote. And so 60% whites ensured that there would be five seats for whites, no seats for blacks, even though there were 40% blacks in the state. And there were endless devices of that sort that we used to minimize the impact of black voting when people could be registered to vote. So dealing with those issues became the major focus of the office that we created on a regional basis. When the summer of 1964 loomed and these volunteers were going to go to the South, we joined with other organizations, but we took the lead in establishing a new organization called the Lawyers Constitutional Defense Committee, which brought together about eight organizations and which sent lawyers to the same areas where the students were going. And we brought more than 100 lawyers to the South to assist the students who were engaged in the registration efforts, but also to deal with a lot of other matters that took place. And I've never been clear that the lawyers made a great deal of difference during that summer, but as somebody said in the film, its biggest effect was on them, because the majority of the lawyers who went south for that period came from large law firms. And they were associates at the large law firms. They had graduated from the top law schools in the country. And after their experience in Mississippi, but also in the vicinity of St. Augustine, Florida, in the vicinity of Bogalusa, Louisiana, few of them wanted to resume their practice at those major law firms. And so the majority of them gave up those careers and went to work in some way that they could carry on the efforts on behalf of civil rights, on behalf of civil liberties. Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is shown in that film, hadn't been one of the volunteer lawyers. She was actually one of the organizers, but she came to work as a lawyer for us at the ACLU in 1964. After the summer, she came on as assistant legal director of the ACLU. I became in 1965 the director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, and I hired a couple of the attorneys who had gone south in 1964 for the staff of the New York Civil Liberties Union. And that sort of thing was repeated all over the country. So for the volunteers, and I think this was true of the students as well as the lawyers, the most significant impact, I think, was the transforming effect upon them. I would also say, with respect to the sequence of the film dealing with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, Fannie Lou Hamer was really one of the great inspiring figures to emerge during that period. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party failed at the 1964 Democratic Convention. And, you know, people who I knew, like Joe Rao and Walter Ruther, Joe did a lot, but then at the last moment caved to the pressure of the United Auto Workers, for whom he was general counsel, and that was immensely disappointing. But 4 years later, at the 1968 Democratic Convention, a desegregated slate was seated in to replace the regular Democratic Party. So it didn't pay off in 1964. But the next time there was a national convention, it did pay off. And a black pharmacist from Clarksdale, Mississippi, became the National Democratic Committee man, and a woman who was my friend, Patricia Darien, who became later the first U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, became the National Democratic Committee woman for Mississippi. She was white, he was black, and that desegregated slate represented the Democratic Party in Mississippi. So this was a period, I think, that had a transforming effect on the country, transforming because it epitomized the civil rights struggle, and over time, significant parts of that civil rights struggle succeeded, although there's still a very long way to go. But it had a transformative effect because it propelled a significant number of people into efforts to protect rights. And that element of what took place in Mississippi in 1964 may have had as much impact as what was actually achieved on the ground in Mississippi in that period.
Thank you.
Cortland.
What I'd like to do today is look at the Mississippi Freedom Summer from two perspectives. First is from 1964, and I'll probably focus on that in my opening remarks, and later on I'll try to look at it from 2014 looking back. But I think if we want to talk about 1964, we really have to start in 1960. Most of the people who were really the organizers of 1964 Freedom Summer were people who began their work in the protest movement in the freedom rides and the sit-ins in 1960. And most of those people were from HBCUs. They were called Negro colleges. But I and many people I know went to Howard University. John Lewis and Diane Nash came from Fisk. Ruby Doris came from Spelman. Julian Bond from Morehouse. People from Albany State, Shaw, North Carolina A&T, South Carolina State, Grambling, Jackson State, Tougaloo, Mississippi, Joyce Ladner, Dory Ladner. We can name a lot. Almost every HBCU were part of the organizing effort that became SNCC in 1960 at the meeting in Shore. Now, I think most of us really were, in 1960, I was 19 years old. Many people were younger than I am. And people who were 25 and 26, like Bob Moses, Jim Foreman, were considered ancients. We really came together at that point to try to eliminate what was obvious to us, mainly college students, trying to eliminate discrimination in public accommodations. That effort from the Freedom Rides and the sit-ins were really important in terms of how people from Mississippi viewed us. I think one of the things that we have to see from the Freedom Rides and the sit-ins is that the students from all these HBCUs, formerly Negro colleges, were fearless. They were fearless in the face of intimidation. They were fearless in the face of death threats. They were fearless in the face of jailing. Because it was the view of those in the South that if they showed enough force, they would intimidate the young people. So when they put the young people in jail, the young people decided that they would do jail no bail, and therefore fill up the jails. When they said they were going to use brutality, police brutality, the Klan brutality, and to stop the Freedom Rides, people kept going into Alabama and Mississippi. When the Justice Department was told, and they relayed the message to people like Diane, say they plan to kill you, Diane said, we've already made out our wills. So at that point, people were fearless, and they showed that this, as King used to say, this was an idea whose time had come. The other thing that was important for the people in Mississippi as they were watching this on their TV screens was that people were willingness to leave their homes, where they lived, where they went to school, and travel to the places of danger, and to begin to end those kinds of segregation, the public accommodation that existed at that time. And finally, the other thing that did not intimidate the young people, at that point we had McCarthyism and the communist scare. And people from the SNCC and the young people said, hey, that's not about us. We were dealing with what we had to deal with. So when people, we started organizing in Mississippi in 1961. So when people came to Mississippi, from SNCC and other organizations, they were all viewed as freedom riders. That's what they were called, freedom riders, because people were impressed with the fearlessness that people had in terms of trying to confront what they had to see and deal with on a daily basis. Now, from 1961 to 1964, there were efforts to organize. When we went into Mississippi, we were told by the World War II veterans, and you also need to understand that we were able to survive in Mississippi. We were able, the young people were able to survive in Mississippi precisely because of these World War II veterans who had, from the time they came back from the World War II until, you know, we came there, they were continuously fighting for the freedom that they so was supposed to be fighting for in World War II. People like Medgar Evers, people like Amzi Moore, people like E.W. Stephenson. These were people who had been in the war, who had fought the war and decided that they were going to bring an end to this at this point. They had, you know, meetings in the 50s in Mississippi where they had 10,000 people in Mount Bayou who'd come to Mississippi to talk about how you begin to organize for the vote. So therefore, we came into Mississippi not in a blank slate. We came in where a number of people from World War II had laid the groundwork to help us understand what was going on, to help guide us, to feed us, to give us housing, and yes, to protect us. And protect, I mean, in every sense of the word. We were able to begin to lay the groundwork from 1961 to 1963-64. And the reason that one of the things that we found was that the violence in Mississippi in the name of maintaining the economic status quo was extremely violent. And so therefore, a number of people, and we know the one, we know Medgar Evers got shot, but Herbert Lee got shot. I mean, there were probably at least 100 people who were shot and killed, and nobody cared. And so, and in fact, in 1964, when they were dragging the river for the bodies of Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney, they drug up, you know, hundreds of bodies. And at the end, I mean, they just threw them back because in 1963, if you were black and you were killed, nobody really cared. So so what began to happen is, you know, Al Lowenstein came to Mississippi in 63. He said, you know, we could bring some students from Stanford, bring some students from Yale, bring some students from the various top colleges down to work with you. And this would open up, this would bring the country to Mississippi. So Bob Moses thought about it, thought that it was a good idea, and it was a contentious idea for a lot of the SNCC organizers because they thought that they would increase the danger for a lot of the people who were living there and for the SNCC organizers. And when people, you know, the SNCC organizers raised this with Ms. Hamer, Charlie Cobb relates this story. You know, Ms. Hamer said, you know, Charlie, we let you come because you were helpful. Why don't you want these people? We need all the help we can get. So with that kind of perspective, the Freedom Summer was open to bringing the country to Mississippi. And I think the film shows what happened as a result of that discussion. Later on in the conversation, I'll give my perspective of how I see Freedom Summer from looking back 50 years back. But I think I'll stop there and, you know, let others speak.
Thank you, Cortland. Jonathan?
So I wasn't there 50 years ago, so apologize for that off the bat. But as working with young people, kind of 50 years later, watching the film, I could see kind of our legacy and where we picked up certain aspects of the movement moving forward. So the First one, just the idea of summer. So every year, thousands of youth organizers in youth organizing groups do their summer youth leadership. It's an opportunity where they rebuild their ranks and prepare for the next set of campaigns for the fall. And so we clear that that's a part of the legacy that we've inherited from Freedom Summer. I think also for education organizers has been the Freedom School and the idea of school as a site of transformation, school as a site for change, and organizing as part of education's idea that that education and organizing go together because it's about a construction of self, also a reconstruction of society. And so that's permeated through a lot of our organizing. I think the other part is that the reality that now Mississippi is everywhere. And so when we understand the movie or what was what they centered on Mississippi, we can find elements of Mississippi all across the country. And so when we look for the school to prison pipeline, when we look at segregated schools, when we look at school closings and the resulting deaths of young people, LaPortia Massey during Albert's in Chicago, even tying in the connection Trayvon Martin, Jordan Davis, and even Mike Brown, we can see that Mississippi exists all across the country and that schools are more segregated today than they were 50 years ago. And it's to be noted that this is the first school year to start where the majority of students will be Black and Brown students. And so that's some of the challenge that we face moving forward. But I think also what I see was the level of fearlessness and courage that was present 50 years ago, that's present today. I had the opportunity to travel to Ferguson for 5 days and to help organize young people there. And when they told their story about squaring off or facing the police, there was that level of fearlessness that they thought that they were gonna die. But for them, it was their stand their ground moment. And that if they were gonna die, then they were gonna die with some dignity. And so you saw them face that, but then after walking through that, beginning to think about what's next and how do they move forward and how does Ferguson become a rally call for all young people to really take up the challenge to change the country and to change the world. So I'll stop there.
Thanks, Jonathan. I don't know if Budapest can hear us. Anna, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Do you hear me?
Yes, we hear you fine.
Oh, okay. So first of all, thank you very much for the invitation. It's a great honor for me personally, but what is more important that the Roma issues are being represented in such an international event. Thank you very much. I am supposed now to represent 12 million people in Europe and probably somewhere around or even more than 15 million all over the world. And I'm not sure I can take this responsibility, so let me focus more or less on Europe, my region, Eastern Europe, and by my personal experience, which is around 2-3 years of Roma youth activism. So as I have said, Roma are the biggest European ethnic minority. And after 40 years of activism, it all started in 71 near London. We are still seen as the burden of Europe, as the dirt of Europe, but we are fighting and we are trying to gain our equality. As watching the movie, it was very inspiring for me, and I started to think whether we have had similar initiatives during these 40 years, and I have to say that we do. In many countries, we are trying and fighting for education for Roma children about their history and their culture. Most of these activities are done by grassroots organization. The mainstream society, I would say, doesn't really know about them. And of course, they are not getting educated about the history of Roma, which includes persecution of hundreds of years and also during the Holocaust. Listening to these inspiring speeches in the movie, I thought whether we have something similar, and yes, of course, we have very courageous and bold activists, and fortunately, does have their work and our work together does have a result. Now we can say that since 2011, we have the European framework for the inclusion of Roma, and the member states, EU member states, and members of the Decade of the Roma Inclusion have their national strategies for the social integration of Roma. This is a success, I would say. But unfortunately, up to now, the implementation of most of these policies seem to be failing because of the poor monitoring and evaluation strategies we are using. What also made me the movie made me think about is that gaining rights to vote is very feasible goal for a movement. Unfortunately, on the international, on the European level, usually about within the Roma movement, we are talking about very beautiful and big goals like equality, like justice. But I believe that we fail to talk about these smaller steps. And even though 40 years have been gone since we started, but we are still very impatient. Also, what was and what is always very interesting for me when learning or reading about the civil rights movement in the US is that these people, to be able to be this brave and bold, they did need the support of the society, I believe. And unfortunately, especially in Eastern Europe these days, as the political sphere is changing, this is the hardest thing to gain. So we do need support, and for this we do need these events where we can speak and we can raise our voices for equality. Thank you.
Thank you, Anna. You know, as I was doing work as an educational equity activist, I kept coming across the Roma people and the Romani movement for educational equity. And so the connections are so clear to me of the state of Black participation here, societal participation here in the United States, and Romani participation in Eastern Europe. And I'm wondering about international implications of Freedom Summer and whether there was an international reaction, and if so, what was it, and was it significant?
You know, before I talk about that, I want to say something about the Roma struggle in Eastern Europe, and what I'm saying is in part sparked by the comments of Cortland Cox. Cortland Cox pointed out rightly that a lot of the young people in SNCC came from the historic Black colleges in the United States, that colleges like Morehouse and Spelman and Fisk and Howard played an immensely significant role, and they created, they helped to create a kind of intellectual elite among American Blacks. There is no historic equivalent for the Roma. No one created colleges of that sort for the Roma in Europe. And so there was not a capacity to call upon an elite produced by those colleges to lead the Roma struggle. A critical part of the Roma programs that the Open Society Foundations are engaged in focuses on Roma education and has focused, among other things, on helping to create an educated elite within the Roma, because if there's going to be any significant headway on Roma rights issues, there has to be the counterpart of the intellectual elite that the Courtland Cox was talking about. Without those people who graduated from those universities, we would not have gotten anywhere near as far as we have gotten in the United States. And the Roma movement has an immense amount to overcome, because there had not been historically colleges like the historic black colleges in the United States, which played that significant role. As far as the international ramifications, I would mention two things. This was going on in the United States at the same moment that many countries in Africa, which had been colonial states, were becoming independent. And the United States was engaged in a Cold War competition with the Soviet Union for the for influence, for the loyalty and affection of those states that were in the process of becoming independent. And as you can well imagine, the Soviet side used to great effect the images of violence in the United States, the water hoses, the dogs, the cattle prods, all of that sort of thing. And so a significant number of the African states opted for a sort of, in fact, in general, the African states opted for one party states very much along a Marxist line. And for the United States to compete with the Soviet Union in that era for influence in the African countries, what was going on in the United States was a major disadvantage. Those images were very widely reproduced in Africa during that period. The other comment I'd make about international ramifications is that I said that a lot of the lawyers and a lot of the demonstrators had their own lives changed. In the United States, the protest movements against the war in Vietnam followed very hard on the heels of the high point of the civil rights movement. And a lot of those who took part in the civil rights movement in that period also became leaders of the anti-war movement. Also, as far as the lawyers were concerned, became the lawyers for the people who were subject to mass arrests during demonstrations against the war, or the lawyers for those who sought conscientious objection status and were turned down, or the lawyers for those who burned their draft cards to protest against the war. So its transforming effect was in some ways reflected in the anti-war movement that followed upon the civil rights movement. I don't believe the anti-war movement could have been as significant were it not for the involvement of many people who cut their teeth on involvement in rights through their involvement in the civil rights era demonstrations, the Freedom Summer and other efforts. I agree very much with Courtland Cox that you have to go back to 1960 and the sit-ins and the Freedom Rides after the sit-ins, or you could go back to 1955 and the Montgomery bus boycott in talking about the roots of what happened in 1964. And a lot of people got involved over a period of years in the civil rights effort. I can tell you, for example, shortly before joining the staff of the ACLU, I spent 2 or 3 months in Chicago. I had been asked to go there by a firm that built intentionally desegregated housing. And they had acquired two tracts of land in a segregated suburb of Chicago, Deerfield, Illinois. And after they acquired the tracts of land and it was learned that they intended to build desegregated housing, the town condemned both parcels of land for park purposes. And we went to court, or the organization went to court, to challenge this. Joe Rao, in fact, was the lawyer in the case. And eventually the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear the case. And then the people who wanted to build the desegregated housing asked me to go to Chicago to organize demonstrations against segregation in Deerfield, Illinois. And among other things, I organized a 12-mile march from the center of Chicago to Deerfield. And we tented in overnight, over a Saturday night, on the property that was supposed to be where the desegregated housing would go. And I had arranged with Martin Luther King that he would come and deliver a Sunday morning service at the site. But things were hopping in Birmingham, and at the last moment, he couldn't come, so we did the service without him. But things like that were going on in different parts of the country, not only in the South in that period. And a lot of people in the United States took part. And then the anti-war movement, in a sense, capitalized on the experience people had in the social cause activity.
Cortland, you worked since SNCC, you have worked in business development, and I wonder if you would just talk about the role of economic justice in the civil rights movement.
Yeah. I think at the end of the day that the issues and problems that we face are much more economic than racial. That, you know, Africans did not find themselves in the United States because people disliked them. They found themselves in the United States because at the end of the day, people wanted labor that would be used to develop an economy. And on top of that, they developed a number of things to protect that whole thrust that they were engaged in terms of economic exploitation. First, they created political exclusion. And that political exclusion is memorialized in the Constitution of the United States. The second is that they engaged in physical intimidation. And third, they engaged in cultural alienation. So that you had four things operating at the same time. First, you had slavery, which was the use of African labor without compensation. Two, you had political exclusion because they could not participate in anything. Three, you had the physical intimidation. And four, you had cultural alienation. The only thing that changed that was when the industrial North needed to establish a different economic set of an economic agenda, and therefore the two could not exist in the same space and time, and so therefore the North was able to end slavery. Now, so that was a big change in terms of the relationship and the dynamic that occurred. Now, after that, you had a brief period called Reconstruction, where African Americans were trying to establish first public education systems. They were trying to do a number of the social programs that we now advocate today. But after the period of Reconstruction, when the North had consolidated its economic hegemony in terms of, you know, the way this country was going to function, then they allowed the second kind of economic exploitation to occur. It was called sharecropping. That's what and that situation existed till we saw 1964. And again, what also made our ability to challenge that economic situation with its attendant political exclusion, physical intimidation, and cultural alienation was World War II and the Cold War, which previous speakers spoke about, because the United States now had you had the end of colonialism, which was the end of an economic system, but also the United States in its ascendancy found itself in competition in the Cold War, and it had to deal with certain kinds of realities, which gave us some space to move and do things in the United States. Just a slight piece on the international. A lot of the concept of nonviolence was something that Mahatma Gandhi developed in his efforts to deal with in South Africa and India. And that was brought into, so some of the intellectual property and the intellectual thinking about how you deal with these issues were not invented in the United States, but brought into the concept. King himself became a disciple of nonviolence. Bayard Rustin, people from the Fellowship of Reconciliation, A.J. Mustey and Dave Dillingen, people like that. So, I mean, those things were important in terms of what we're dealing with. I think the economic discussion is important as we look at what we're dealing with today. For Black people in the United States, you had exploitation under slavery, and there was clear use of Black labor to do that. Then you had sharecropping, and that was a whole system that used that in terms of what we have, you know, up until probably, 1970 or so. But now what we have today with young people is that we're now switching from an industrial age to an industrial economy to an information economy. And there is no need for labor that is not educated. And so there, what is now beginning to happen to all this labor that was built on either denial of education under slavery or sharecropping education under the previous situation in terms of sharecropping, where you have, Blacks who are not educated, there is no place for them to go in a non-industrial economy. So basically what they're doing is being sent to jail or being warehoused in some other fashion. And the question then becomes, as we look at the present day fight, it seems to be a big question, at least on the economic issues, has to be around education and the kind of education that will allow people, not only people of color, but people who are poor across the board, to be able to function in an information economy. And also, how do you protect that motion with the whole issue of voting rights? Because basically, the question of the ability to move economically also has to be protected by the ability to move politically. I think the physical intimidation that we saw previously is not there. And the cultural alienation, where some people might disagree, but I think at least in the Black community, the cultural alienation was exploded by Stokely Carmichael and others who advocated Black power and the sense of beauty and not feeling that you were the other, you that you were important. So my sense, the big fight that we have today is how do we now move those who are poor and who have no skills to be able to function in an information economy? And the kind of literacies that you're going to need that I did not have, you know, you're going to have computer literacy. You're going to have math literacy. You're going to have to, in addition to English literacy and other kinds of literacies to function in an information economy. How do we now educate a whole community of people to function in an information economy is the big question that we face at this point. And how do we now begin to advance those kinds of interests by creating a political climate that includes everyone? Let me just say one last thing about Ferguson. I want to say people have mentioned Ferguson. One of the things that bothered me, I mean, in Lowndes, I worked in Lowndes County in 1965, 66. And in 1965, 66, we went into Lowndes County. Lowndes County was 80% Black, and there were 4 African Americans who were registered to vote. Our view was that you not only had to register people to vote, that you had to be able to control that vote, one. 2, that if you were dealing with police brutality with the sheriff, it's no use just complaining and, quote, speaking truth to power. You needed to replace that sheriff with your own sheriff. If you had a problem with the tax assessor, you replace that with your own tax assessor. If you had, they should, so that in 4 years in Lowndes County in 1965, after 4 years of organizing and so forth, that we had a regime change. I think that as we discuss Ferguson and other places, we ought not to be just talking about protests. We need to now say we have a place that's 67% African American, and we have those kinds of conditions. Why are we arguing and trying to have a conversation with them? We don't need to have a conversation among ourselves. In 2 to 4 years, nobody who is in office now in Ferguson should be in office. We should be training people to assume power. We should be training people to move to hire their own police chief. We should be working with the Justice Department and others to train local police and make sure that those who were not in the police force are properly trained now to protect and serve. This is a discussion about who is going to, voting is not only a discussion about who votes and exercise some abstract power. Voting is about what is government going to look like? Who is it going to serve? Who is going to participate? What resources are going to go where? We now have to have a real discussion just beyond voting, which is an abstract discussion, because for people like me, that's great because I have all the money I need and, you know, I don't have, you know, it's not a big issue. It can be an abstract discussion. But for most people, particularly those who are poor, it's about their existence and how they live in the future.
So I want to open it up for questions to folks here in New York and in DC and Baltimore and Budapest. If you have any questions for our panelists, now's the time. Makichi, is that your hand, I see?
Allison, yes. First of all, thank you so much for planning and organizing this. Actually, I'm going to throw it back again to Courtney Cox, if I might, because in the beginning you said you were going to look at the perspective from 2014 down. And the reason I want to hear a little bit about that, because nearly 50 years after the Freedom Summer, you had someone elected to the City Council of Jackson, Mississippi, and then later to the mayorship of Jackson, Mississippi, whose political ideology was far from the We Shall Overcome, but took more so of the Stokely Carmichael Kwame Ture Black Power methodology. And I would like to hear your perspective as to just how that happened with respect to that election, and also the whole paradigm of when people would hear Stokely Carmichael say Black Power, it was people would think it was militant, it was revolution, it was far left field. But actually, it was about exactly, from my perspective, what you were saying, the control of the politics and economics of the community and the achievement of empowerment. So if you could kind of address that, and maybe if Jonathan, you can too, because I know you've dealt with a lot of empowerment and thrown to D.C. and the like. So,
yeah. Let me, Mr. Nia, is that, I guess that's his, am I pronouncing your name correctly? Okay. You know, one of the things that you talked about at the end of your presentation, Finn, is the question of Vietnam. And I don't know if you remember, when King gave his speech on Vietnam, the sense was that, ooh, you can only speak about things dealing with race. You can't, this is beyond you. This is, because one of the things that
the New York Times condemned him editorially.
Right. I mean, and so basically one of the things that we've had to fight is how big we can think. How, because people want to define you in your space. So even when King spoke about Vietnam, or Julian Bond, when SNCC issued a statement about Vietnam, I mean, people condemn that. Now we have to think just as human beings. That is to say, young people in Ferguson, just like, you know, Stokely and others, not only thought of, should not only think about those things that people expect them to think about, but they need to think about, which goes to the international piece. I mean, a lot of us not only thought about how we bring powers to communities that we live in and so forth, but we began to think about, you know, the whole world. I mean, how do we relate to Africa? How do we relate to Europe? How do we relate to the big issues? So my sense is that, I mean, one of the things that in terms of, I just want to say something about Black Power for a minute. You know, in the conversation about civil rights, Black Power is considered, quote, the bad part, because, you know, it did not, you know, there's this song, I don't know who sang it, Carly Smith or somebody said, "You so vain, you think this song is about you." And for many whites, they felt that this was a bad part because they were not included. That was not the discussion. The discussion was, and remember I said there were four things that happened, cultural alienation. One of the things that, you know, the Black Power discussion did, and it spanned throughout. I mean, I meant to Gray Power, and, you know, all sorts of other people thought about it in the ways that it said, we understand ourselves to be worthy. We understand ourselves to be beautiful. We understand our broad noses have beauty. Our kinky hair has whatever. Our black skin has whatever we value that we want to have to it. And not only are we able to think of ourselves as worthy and beautiful, we're able to think of ourselves as being able to control our own lives. We're not going to exist in somebody else's definition. So I think that while the word black was attached to the question of power, I think at the end of the day, it really was, I think the Panthers came up, power to the people, black power to black people. I mean, I think at the end of the day, it was the whole effort for you not to be defined by somebody else and some other things. And, you know, I just think that, that, you know, in terms as I see where we go in the future, is important for everybody who's engaged in the discussion not to be just confined to discussion of race. They need to be described to, they need to look at the economic discussions, They need to begin to think much more broadly. They need to be thinking about the information economy. They need to be thinking about how do you organize to give people hope that they will want to vote, because just saying vote is not going to get it. You got to give people the reason to vote so that they see at the end of the rainbow that there is something there for them. And they have, you have to give them some sense of themselves, that they're worthy and they should be participating. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of what, you know, I see.
So we are at time, unfortunately, but I do want to give Jonathan and Anna the opportunity to maybe speak for a minute. You know, we heard Eleanor Holmes Norton say that we were young and foolish. And I've just, you know, as I think about the impact of that and the need for youth in movements in order to be young and foolish, if you would just talk about how young people, young Romani people, young Black people here have defined their movements, and are there ways that they are being, to put it a little more gently, risky, that grown folks can help support?
So may I start?
Yes.
I've been thinking of exactly what we were talking about right now, about pride and dignity, and being strong and not letting ourselves defining by other people. And I think that we are in that phase right now of the Roma young movement, that there needs to be a process to get strength from each other and to give courage to each other that we are good enough and we can change and we are worthy. Because I believe not necessarily in within Roma intellectuals, but in the everyday life, this is what is missing the most, that people don't believe that their voice matters, their opinion matters, that they can change their own situation and thus other people's situation. So, yeah, maybe we need to initiate something like a Roma beauty movement or similar.
Very good. Very good.
Jonathan?
I'm reminded... there was a group of us, a Freedom Side folk, who a network of youth organizers and college students who had gathered together, and we were preparing to mobilize young people to Freedom Summer. The Alliance was trying to move 300 young people. And I remember sitting with a SNCC vet, and she asked us very squarely and looked at each of the eyes and said, what if you fail? Are you prepared for that? And for us, it was a real moment of like, shock, like, whoa. And she said that was part of what they had to deal with. And also this idea that, you know, this could be it. And so how do you face that? And so I think when we think about young people taking that step forward, it is, you know, helping them to understand that it is okay. And that if they fail, that they will live, that this stuff will work on, that we that they're entitled to make mistakes, I think, and being able to challenge that fear and take that step, very similar, like when young people first learn how to walk, right? You kind of encourage them and take the, you know, and even if they fall, it's okay, get up, and let's continue to walk. And so I think that is the role that young people adults can play. That was some of what I understand the role of Ella Baker was, with helping to think about and to take those steps. And then when you fail, to brush off the need to say that at a girl, at a boy, and continue to march forward.
Thank you all. Thank you all so much for participating in all of the various offices and for being here today. This is wonderful. Thank you.